Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. Our guest today is Kristen Gary. She's a private art dealer who manages Kristen Gary Fine Art, a private gallery that includes European Old Masters, 19th century European, American 20th century, and select contemporary works. She's been dealing privately since 1999 and has been in the art world since 93. Kristen, can you take a minute and just tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
I started in the art world in 1994. I started studying art history at Duke University and then decided to move to Italy for a couple of years. So I was working in Florence. I was studying at the Art Institute for Art History and Restoration there. Then I moved to Amsterdam for a year, and then eventually was hired by a gallery called Colmaggi. That's a European Old Master art gallery that was based out of London, Paris, and New York at the time. So I started working for them in 94. I worked there for, 3 years. And then I moved to Doyle Galleries, which is an auction house on the Upper East Side, until 1999. In 1999, I decided that the art world needed another independent art dealer. So I left the auction world and decided to set up my own shop. And I've been doing it ever since.
I know that you have sort of a special focus. I mean, for the past several years, you've been working on sorting out and breaking up collections, whether in the wake of bankruptcy or death, or just the artists need to divest or the estates need to divest for some other reason. I'm curious, you know, a couple of the collections you've worked on have been pretty high profile and perhaps challenging. I wonder what you can tell us, if anything, about the kinds of challenges that you face in this kind of work.
Well, I got into bankruptcy work. It was, I would say, kind of a fluke. I had been dealing in Old Masters for many years, and a friend of mine had asked me at an art fair if what I thought of a gallery. And I said, you know, I see a lot of beautiful things, but I also see a lot of things that really make me question the authenticity of what's hanging on the wall and what they're purported to be. And so I suggested that maybe that wasn't the place to be involved with. Long story short, 5 years ahead, Sandra O'Reilly had gotten in big trouble, padlocked the door, major bankruptcy case, and all of the assets that had come out of both the personal collection and the gallery needed to be sold, and they needed to basically create money to pay back the creditors. So that's where I came in. In this particular case, because I knew personally one of the people who had invested, that group brought me into work with that collection of inventory that had been deemed specifically theirs. And after working with that for a couple of months, I was introduced to the larger section of the bankruptcy case, and I became art advisor for the entire thing. When I first saw all of the works that came out of the gallery and the private residence and other collections that were coming in, it was like that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark when at the end of the movie he opens up the inventory, the storage facility, and the Ark is in that building with like a million pieces of inventory. And when I went to the storage facility, that's what I felt at the beginning. I mean, there were thousands of pieces that came out of there, ranging from the 12th century through to modern painting. So it's been quite a Herculean task.
Well, I wonder, how important do you think it is for artists, organizations, administrators of collections to plan in advance for some kind of divestiture, regardless of the cause, and how can they do so?
Obviously, you want to keep as many records as possible and photography and databases. As far as a living artist is concerned, I think if you're a gallerist or someone who is dealing with the gallery, you have to make sure that your contracts are in line. And I think the biggest takeaway from the troubles that Sounder had were people that had consigned multiple works to him had not filed UCC agreement, UCC filings. And so because the bankruptcy hit and very few people had filed UCCs, it was a big mess.
So in addition to this, I mean, the list is long of what art dealers often do. So art dealers will sometimes help in the appraisal process, insurance assistance, locating art for purchase, assisting with bidding at auctions, selling pieces, conservation, collection management, even assistance in framing. Does your range extend that far? And if not, what is your focus?
I think art dealers, I mean, I'm a private dealer, so I don't work out of a gallery. I work out of my office, and I have a very small, I'm a much more nimble operation, let's say. I don't have a gallery where I'm creating exhibitions and moving things out on a daily basis. When I do that, I usually use a gallery of a friend. And I just wanted, I did that because I wanted to be more nimble and have the flexibility to come and go as I needed to. I think that I provide all of those services for my clients. And the only thing that I'm not doing on a more regular basis, I guess, would be exhibitions, which gallerists, I think, do on a continual basis. I do less exhibitions. But that being said, from everything that I've seen in the art world and not only witnessed, but also it's become a fact that the people are buying at auction and they're buying at art fairs. So the impetus to do exhibitions is kind of becoming less and less at this point, for at least in my art. And I'm dealing with the secondary market. So
what do you think of that trend, that shift toward art fairs? Pro, con, are there good and is there good and bad about it?
That's a good question. I think I'm speaking more specifically, I'm not really speaking to the contemporary world right now, because that's something that has become really kind of its own beast. I deal more with old master paintings in 19th century, early 20th century. Yes, the auction world versus the gallery world has definitely changed. And I think buying trends, I was just at the appraisers conference last week, and there was a presentation by a woman named Claire McAndrews who writes the report for the KFOF, which is the Maastricht Fine Arts International Fair that's been happening for the last 25 years in Maastricht in March. And they have found and analyzed that most of the buying, like it's some astronomical percentage, is either going on at auctions or at art fairs. So dealers, I think, I think it's important for dealers to kind of band together and create these events like the auction houses have done, as we've seen in the past couple of weeks here in New York. I think it drives people and creates a sense of urgency that having a gallery where people are free to go as they please, and they know things are going to be there. They might or might not be there for a week or 2 weeks or 6 months. You know, it creates a sense of energy where people feel that they have to make a decision.
So what kinds of things should an artist or must an artist do when creating or selling a piece of art that will aid the art dealer or an appraiser down the road? Are there things they should really be thinking about that you see there's a gap?
I'm just making a joke right now. I'm coming from more of the old master world, but sign your paintings. Please sign your paintings. Sign a date your paintings. I think that as far as contemporary artists, I work with two contemporary artists. They're both Italian. One lives in Palermo, and the other one lives in Rome. And I think both of them, or at least one of them, definitely keeps very, very careful inventory of the pieces that he's working on and where these pieces go and how they're sold. I think that's kind of indispensable at this point. The other artist that I work with is a sculptor, and I think a lot of things, you know, there's so many maquettes that he's working on, because he works in terracotta and in marble and bronze and all kind of all the sculptural medium. So, but I, you know, the trial phases for creating these bronzes and larger pieces are so many. But as you know, these these things become very valuable as time passes. So make sure you hold on to them or know where they're going.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, the importance of not only keeping an inventory of your art, but also tracking of where it's currently hanging, where it's being displayed, you know, and the income around it. You know, the Clark Hulings Fund offers a tool, Artwork Archive, that specifically helps artists do this with their clients. And for those that are interested in that, you can actually visit clarkhulingsfund.org and just click on the tools section to find that. We'll give you a 20% discount off of Artwork Archive. But the important thing is that we need some kind of system to determine, you know, not only where the art is, but where are the receipts being stored? What, you know, how is the art performing economically, et cetera? So I'm really glad you sort of put your finger on that button.
I think that's an amazing tool, and people and artists should absolutely make use of it. It's indispensable. You look at the auctions and what things and the small pieces from artists that are selling now, and if we knew exactly where these had all been, and it would just add to the piece. I mean, provenance is incredibly, incredibly important. So being able to track that, I think, in the future will be a big factor in the value of a work.
Yeah, I mean, that brings us right to collectors, because it's not just important for artists. I mean, this tool we're referring to, Artwork Archive, does this for collectors as well. So you have a 19th century European piece, and you need to do a lot of tracking and also be able to provide documentation. And if you have a meaningful collection, being able to understand the economic value and growth of your collection, where it's being displayed, and being able to display virtual pieces so people can understand what it is that you're talking about. All of that stuff is important.
And for keeping up with insurance, too. I mean, a lot of people create these collections and then insure them 10 or 15 years ago, and the market changes, and you really have to keep up with that.
Exactly. So if there are collectors listening who would like to find out more about that tool, visit clarkhulingsfund.org and look for the tools section, because I think that you may be impressed with what you can now do in the technological world very easily on behalf of your collection. So tell me, are there ways, Kristen, that collectors can actually help you in the research and appraisal process? Are there best practices they should be following that just sort of make life easier for you or make it simpler to help you help them?
I think that it's very basic. It really is. Save your receipts, save your invoices, and inventory any kind of information that you have when you're purchasing something. It makes it infinitely easier for an appraiser or for a dealer to move forward knowing that all of this information is in order. Especially for the 19th century and old master things, a lot of information gets lost. So a chain of ownership is a beautiful thing. And it traces, it goes back to the idea that, you know, you own artwork, but really you don't, because you're just the custodian of it for a small amount of time. And it's wonderful if you can have the chain of ownership from the time that it's been, from its time of inception until today, let's say. So that is very helpful for anyone who is buying and selling art.
Kristen, how can artists protect themselves and their pieces in the case of bankruptcy or a gallery going into foreclosure? Are there things they need to be thinking about to make sure that they're not caught off guard or by surprise?
I think the biggest piece of information, my biggest takeaway from working in the Salander case was file a UCC. It doesn't, you know, the gallery world, the art world is beautiful for some things in that you have a great relationship with your dealer and you trust each other. And a lot of things are said and agreed upon verbally and with a handshake. And that's a great thing. But sometimes things so pear-shaped. And in that case, you really need to have a contract. And if you are consigning anything to a gallery, you should file a UCC. It's a very simple, filing. You make it with the Secretary of State, and it basically protects you in the case of bankruptcy. You are a secured interest. So as things are being divided and basically understood who owns what, you will have the primary, you'll be the first in line to either receive your piece or receive the full compensation for the work.
For those that aren't familiar with this, what does that stand for? What does it mean really?
It's the UCC is the Uniform Commercial Code. And it's a very simple filing that you file with the Secretary of State of New York or whatever state it is. And it basically gives you a secured interest in, it states to the world, because they are public, that you have a secured interest in the piece of work that you are giving, that you are consigning to the gallery.
So this is something that you should do in conjunction with having a gallery agreement. You should not just assume that the agreement is enough and focus on the language of the agreement, but it's really important to file the UCC also. And the methodology might be different on a state-by-state basis.
It is. But the consignment agreement will not protect you. The only thing that protects you, I mean, it will help, but it will not entirely protect you. So you definitely need to file it.
So let me ask you a more personal sort of question about your business. How do you, as a private dealer, manage and keep your client base?
You know, I'm a private dealer, and I have to say I'm a little under the radar. So most of my work and dealings are word of mouth. All of the major bankruptcy estates has been word of mouth, and I think that in my case, it's really it's based on trust and reputation. The art world can be a confusing and opaque place, and I serve my clients by being very upfront about what I think in any case about what they want to buy or what they want to sell. And so I try to do them justice by being as direct and open as possible. You know, I think that the open book policy is the best way.
I'm curious, how do you balance the need to deal works that will sell versus dealing with pieces that you like as a dealer and that really fit your interest?
That's funny. That's a funny question. My boyfriend is always like, why do you deal with those paintings? They sell like hotcakes. And, you know, giving an example, like, I don't like those paintings, like, but they're so commercial, you can make so much money. And I don't know, I just like working with the things that I find interesting and aesthetically important and beautiful examples of an artist's work. So I'm not driven by how easily commercial something is.
Well, let me ask you about genre bias in general. Do you think that the issue of genre bias, sort of having factions or clubs around individual genres, that is helpful or harmful to the world of art? Or does it create problems for you and challenges for the artists you deal with?
Well, I think you're always going to have people who are more open to different and new art. I mean, I started off with old masters, and I love parts of contemporary art as well. I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily a problem. Some people are passionate about a very, very specific, kind of art. I mean, I have some clients who only collect Bolognese 17th century drawings. So that's what they love. That's what they're interested in, and that's what they're passionate about. And a lot of the times when I have clients like this, they know more about it than I do, because that's all they read about and that's all they care about. And so I personally don't see a problem in people. It's like developing a deep passion for a very specific thing. I personally don't have a problem with that.
So tell me about how the market in your industry today differ from when you first started out.
I would say the primary force that has changed for the markets that I work in is the emergence of the all-encompassing auction house. I think that they've really pushed the limits and gone from, there used to be a very symbiotic relationship between dealers and an auction house, and dealers would find things at auction, and there was a lot less contact with the buyer, the client. And now the auction houses have really, I think, controlled the market and taken over the direct contact with the collector. I mean, especially if you're looking at the contemporary auctions that just happened, it's amazing, really. Their network that they have and the clients that they're creating. For me, since I work more with old masters in the 19th century, I would say the access to information on the internet has made, I think, the largest change. I think it's great. I think it's wonderful, the information that we have, in 3 seconds, as opposed to going over to the Frick or the Watson and having to look everything up. I think it makes our life a lot easier. So I embrace it.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of fun questions to just sort of wind down the show. So from the time when you first started in this line of work, if you knew then what you know now and could go back and do one thing differently, what would that be?
I've thought about this, actually, and I think that for the development of my career, I would have started first working in an auction house. I think working in an auction house is an amazing, amazing experience because, well, first of all, you're always going at 1,000 miles an hour. And just the sheer number of paintings and works that you see on a continual basis, I think is indispensable for creating your eye. And in dealing with old masters and secondary market things, you need to be able to discern, is it Rubens? Is it Studio Rubens? Is it Workshop of Rubens? And the only way you can do this is by seeing paintings come in all the time. And I think that's really important. And the other is just the wide reach that the auction house has. I think that would be wonderful. And then go and work in a gallery after that. That would be my primary change.
If you could have one technology or superpower to do something you're currently not able to do with your art career, what would that be?
That's a good one. Maybe would being Superman with X-ray vision help me to see through some of my old master pictures and see if there's an underdrawing underneath? That could be very helpful.
There you go. So X-ray vision is a popular choice. I commend it. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. To find out more about Kristen Gary Fine Art, visit KristenGaryFineArt.com. And for more information on the fund, visit ClarkHulingsFund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Kristen. It's been really great having you.
Thanks so much, Daniel. I appreciate it.